You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a Wisconsin appeals court handed down a decision that could affect people's arrest records and background checks. We'll talk to a lawyer involved in that case. Right now, accreditation is important for universities to be viable and competitive. They're granted that status through government-approved accreditation agencies. New reporting looked into how one of those agencies decided to accredit a school called Reagan National University in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The problem with that university, it doesn't seem to exist. Since the story came out, Secretary of Education Betsy DeVos says her department is investigating the issue. Chris Quintana is a higher education reporter for USA Today. He worked on the story with Shelley Conlon of the Argus Leader in Sioux Falls. Chris, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
What first put you and your colleague on the story of Reagan National University in South Dakota?
Yeah, so I had been writing about the story as it relates to the accrediting body, ACICS. They had pulled out of a trade group, and I was trying to find a way to make that a little bit more interesting to the average reader. And in doing so, I came across Reagan National University, which was unusual to me because I, you know, recognize most of the universities named after presidents, and this one seemed unusual. And from there, we just kind of hit the ground running investigating it.
Yeah, one of the red flags here was that universities who get accredited are required to report how many of their students get jobs. The percentage. What was the percentage that was reported for Reagan National University?
So back in, I want to say January 2019, their job placement rate was 0%, which should raise some red flags. Either there's questions about academic quality, or it begs the question of where the students might actually be.
So 0% of their students got jobs. So what happened when you started digging into this university? What did you find and what didn't you find?
So I was looking for things that most universities would have, right? I was looking for faculty. I was looking for the president. I couldn't find any evidence of either of those things. And as we started to investigate, the university took its website down, which was also very not alarming, but it did raise some questions as to why that was happening right as our investigation was concluding.
And then that takes it back up to where you started, this accrediting agency, the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools. Tell us about their kind of fall and return over the last few years.
Yeah, so they were known for accrediting kind of some high-profile closures of for-profit universities, including ITT Tech and Corinthian Colleges. And in 2016, the Obama-era Education Department moved to strip them of their accrediting power. That was ultimately reversed by Betsy DeVos's agency in 2018 and also following a court decision.
Talking to Chris Quintana from USA Today, we're looking at a university that didn't seem to exist and questions it raises about how colleges and universities are accredited with the federal government. What was the argument for returning this ACIC, the Accrediting Council for Independent Colleges and Schools, back to its status to recognize schools under federal status?
I think there was a sense that perhaps the Obama-era department had overstepped, or that's what the current department has since said. But I think that was the rationale.
I want to give a listen to Betsy DeVos, Secretary of Education. After your story was published, she was asked about it during a hearing of the House Committee on Education. Here she is responding to Democratic Committee Chair Rosa DeLauro.
Well, Chairwoman, I was troubled by reading that piece as well and have directed that an investigation ensue to see what's going on there. I was not happy to read that.
So you would be willing to...
We have an investigation launched and we're on it.
Have you heard anything from this accrediting agency, the ACICS, since your story came out or as part of your reporting for the story?
Well, so we were in touch with them before the story published. We haven't received a comment about the department's investigation.
And do we see signs of an investigation now from the Department of Education, as Secretary DeVos was talking about, or has that not gotten rolling yet, as far as we know?
I think it has. I got a hold of a letter that the department sent to ACICS asking for documentation about a couple of things. you know, like their site visits and any communication they might have had with Reagan. So I think they have until March to respond. So we'll be monitoring that pretty closely on our end.
Now, what would I do with an accredited university that doesn't have any students? Do we have a sense of, I don't know, could I engage in kinds of fraud, or do we know anything that Reagan National University actually did do?
Yeah, so that's a little bit of a challenge that we encountered in our reporting. We did uncover an email from the university's president, Harold Harris, who at one point had written in CSES requesting help getting a .edu domain for the goal of enrolling international students. So there are some universities that will enroll international students with and then don't really require them to go. They're called colloquially visa mills. And so we don't know for sure that that was what was going on here, but it seemed like there was a lot of evidence in that space.
And in your reporting, you saw what appeared to be a connection between this Reagan National University in South Dakota and a previous university that had done something like this, that kind of diploma mill concept for international students. What was the connection?
Yeah, so they had some similar ties to this university called the University of Northern Virginia that had been raided by ICE in the early 2010s. And I think the rationale by ICE at that point was that, you know, there did appear to be activity related to, you know, international students. So there were a lot of common connections there. There, like, for example, the same name appeared on multiple South Dakota documents, and they also shared a business address that we went to and didn't find any evidence of a university out there either.
Now, this is federal accreditation. I understand state laws vary from one state to another, and one reason one might want to open a university in South Dakota, it sounds like they don't have a lot of requirements. So what did you find there?
Yeah, so in South Dakota, we found it was pretty lax. Actually, if you wanted to register with the state, you just had to be accredited. Some states require more. They want, you know, to have student outcomes. They want to know where your students are going and kind of their makeup and that sort of thing. So it was unusual to us that there was appeared to be pretty lax standards here.
Now, as part of reporting on Reagan National University, you or one of your reporting colleagues, I think, visited the campus. What was there?
So Shelley Conlin was the one who visited the campus. She went and found, you know, not a lot, actually. There were some locked doors. There was a sign that said Reagan National University, but there didn't appear to be any lights on or anything like that. And there didn't seem to be any indication, but, you know, there were functioning signs of a university there.
Now, this is an extreme case, maybe, of problems with the accreditation system. What kind of things are you and your colleagues looking at on the wider issue of these agencies that give this accreditation to campuses around the country?
Well, yeah. So, you know, part of the framing for this story was, like, if this university can get accredited, it's like, who else can get accredited? So we're looking at some other universities and colleges to kind of see what else might be in that space. We're not sure what we're going to find, but we're, you know, just giving out a little bit more scrutiny.
Yeah. And remind us, looking back at those colleges that you mentioned, the for-profit colleges that had been accredited by this agency and have since been closed, this affected a lot of their students over the years, right?
Right. And you know, there is a thing where, you know, their student loans might have been forgiven as part of the borrower defense rules, but it doesn't make up for the fact that, you know, they spent all this time and energy kind of being in school. You know, that's like time that they give up not working or being out of the workforce. And it can really throw off a person's life.
What are you watching for next, Chris, as you continue to watch for the to report on this story?
Well, I don't think we're going to find another fake university, but we are looking at kind of, you know, what changes or reforms this might have for the accreditation process. You know, obviously, we saw the Department of Education investigation. We're also looking at South Dakota to see if anything's done there. So we're just trying to look ahead and see kind of what changes, if any, come to the accreditation process.
Chris, thanks a lot for sharing the story with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
That's Chris Quintana, higher education reporter for USA Today. He talked to us about how a college in South Dakota that doesn't appear to exist got accredited by an agency approved by the Department of Education, part of a wider look at how colleges and universities around the country get this federal accreditation, what that process means, and whether fraudulent universities could once again be a factor on the educational landscape. Coming up, a lawyer walks us through the appeals court decision that affirmed her client's right to have arrest records wiped clean in a case that led to no charges being filed. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn about some of the misinformation circulating about COVID-19 and the novel coronavirus. First, some people in Wisconsin face situations where a lingering arrest record can keep them from getting a job, an apartment, situations where their background is checked. In some cases, those arrest records should legally have been removed from Justice Department records. That's according to lawyer Corey Ashley from the nonprofit law firm Legal Action of Wisconsin. Corey recently represented a client who fits that description. I talked to Corey Ashley earlier today. She joined us from our Milwaukee studio. Corey, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, can you tell us about your client in this case and what you were trying to address here?
My client in this case came to Legal Action because they were looking for a way to improve his employability. He's young, and so he knew that he wanted to be able to enter into leasing agreements and not have landlords worry about records of conviction that weren't in fact true. And so he essentially wanted to improve all the things that would make him more self-sufficient. So we ran his criminal record report and discovered that he in fact had some arrest on his report that did not result in convictions or charges for that matter, and gave the misleading impression that he had a criminal history in certain areas that just weren't the case.
Yeah, take us back to the beginning, those initial arrests and charges that ended up being on his record, surprisingly.
Right. So what initially happened is years ago, he was picked up and questioned for a couple of criminal offenses. The district attorney's office very promptly, within 2 days, decided not to charge him with those criminal offenses. And those offenses remained on his background report. And what happens with the they're called criminal history reports or crime information bureau reports, is when you have contact with law enforcement, a cycle is generated on a report that's maintained by the Department of Justice. And the rule is that if that arrest does not result in a conviction, that arrest cycle should properly come off. But the burden is placed on the individual to make that request. And Mr. Hall did not know that at the time. And so those arrests lingered on his report until we submitted the request for removal.
So if I'm in this situation, these things are there, I don't know they're there, these records are going to stay there unless I'm aware of it and go and make a specific request to get them removed. Do I have that right?
Correct. And unless you make that affirmative request, they're going to remain there. And individuals, landlords, employers, educators can pull these reports without the individual's permission. All you need is their first and last name and date of birth. So they're reviewing these reports to determine if you should get that job or if they should rent an apartment to you. And you may not know that you have these arrests sitting on your report that didn't result in charges or convictions. And so they absolutely have a stigmatizing effect.
Is this something that, as far as you know, happens often? Does it happen in many cases of an arrest not resulting in charges, ending up with records with the Department of Justice?
Absolutely. So the Department of Justice last year, more than 1 million of these reports were requested by public users. I do this work regularly at Legal Action. I review these reports weekly, and we are very routinely making requests to the Department of Justice to remove arrest cycles from reports. So this is routinely done. This is stigmatizing countless individuals across the state of Wisconsin.
Now, Mr. Hall your client did make this request, but it didn't automatically result in the expungement, the removal of these records. Why not?
Well, what the Department of Justice said was that because the criminal charges, the criminal arrests were linked to municipal ordinance violations, that they weren't eligible to come off. So another way of saying this is the DOJ, they jumbled unrelated municipal convictions to these criminal arrests. And they said because he was convicted of these municipal court, and they were tickets, by the way, that they didn't have to take the criminal arrests off. Now, the Court of Appeals disagreed with them and ordered that the inaccuracy be corrected. But that's why the initial request was denied.
We're talking to Corey Ashley, an attorney with Legal Action of Wisconsin, looking at what happens to your records. If you're arrested but not charged in a crime, it can be tough to get those expunged. Corey, take us through the legal process. And I know it gets a little complicated here. You were just laying out a couple different opinions from courts. Where are we now? How did we get here on his particular case?
Well, we got here on his particular case because Mr. Hall was, you know, fortunate enough to realize that there was something going on. He kept being denied for jobs. He had issues securing stable housing. And so he had us take a look at his background report. And after that, the process is fairly simple. We send in what's called a fingerprint removal request to the Department of Justice. And we say, look, he has some arrest on his background report that he was not ultimately charged with. He certainly wasn't convicted of. And these should not be on the report. We sent that request. That request was ultimately denied. And we filed an appeal to Milwaukee County Circuit Court. And it was called an administrative agency review. The circuit court reviewed the case. It was briefed, and they agreed with Mr. Hall and ordered that those arrests, those inaccuracies, be removed from his report. And then the DOJ, of course, appealed to the Wisconsin Court of Appeals in District 2.
And that's where we stand now. Why do you think the department is appealing this in this case if, as you're describing, by law, they should be removing these records?
I think that I certainly don't want to speak for the department, but sure. this was a case of really first impression. There's not a lot of administrative decisions revolving around this statute. And I think that their policy is not something that has really been previously challenged. So, you know, I suspect in their mind, they thought that they, you know, had a policy that was correctly interpreting this statute. But certainly I don't want to, you know, speak for them.
Sure. Now, for possible remedies to prevent a case like this in the future, what would need to change? Does a state law need to change? Would a procedure need to change to prevent this happening again?
No, I think under the current statute, I don't think anything would need to change. I think the decision at this point, which made clear that this inaccuracy should come off Mr. Hall's report, at least in this circumstance, with municipal court convictions being jumbled with unrelated criminal arrest, I think that in the future that will help people similarly situated. As far as additional changes, I think these reports could be more informative. The Crime Information Bureau reports are difficult to read the way that they're formatted. I think that they are subject to other inaccuracies. Currently, the way that when you request a report, it matches a person's last name, their first initial, and their date of birth. So, for example, if your name is Jane Dillinger with a date of birth of 2/22/60, your twin brother, if they happen to be a criminal and his name is John, if you request a report for Jane Dillinger, you're always going to get the criminal report for her brother, John. So there are other, I think, things, internal things that can be done to make these reports so much more informative and accurate. But I certainly don't think at this point any legislative changes would be necessary.
Now, suppose someone is out there listening and thinking hypothetically, I got arrested back when I was 20. I never got charged with it. Gosh, I wonder if I have a criminal record sitting there. How would somebody find out something like that?
You can go to recordcheck.doj.org, and the system is pretty user-friendly. You're going to put in your name and your date of birth. It requires that you pay $7, so you will need a debit card. But you're actually able to purchase, like a lot of landlords and employers do on a daily basis, you can purchase your own individual criminal background report, and you can just take a look and see exactly what's on that report. And, you know, Legal Action has offices all over the state, not just in Milwaukee. So I would encourage anyone who has some questions about their report to reach out to us to see if there is some correcting that can be done.
You got to pay for your own report?
You have to pay for your own report. It's $7 for a general report. And if you want a more detailed caregiver report, that report, I believe, is $14.
Corey, as we wrap up, what is the timeline now with this appeal in Mr. Hall's case?
So as of right now, the good news is that Mr. Hall's report, these cycles have come off. So he has a clean report right now. The case is subject to appeal, and they have 90 days, I believe, to do so. So we are, you know, we will, you know, wait patiently to see if that happens. But in the meantime, Mr. Hall is able to, you know, go out and job hunt and look for housing with the record of these arrests off of this report.
Corey, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Corey Ashley, a lawyer with the nonprofit law firm Legal Action of Wisconsin. We talked to her today about an appeals court decision that individuals' arrest records must be cleared for those offenses where they weren't charged with committing a crime. Coming up, there's a lot of misinformation floating around about the novel coronavirus. A Wisconsin public health expert will join the show to clear up some of the misconceptions, make the case for getting things right, and talk a little bit about how concerned we should be and shouldn't be about the illness as it spreads in the country and dominates the news. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. A federal appeals court heard arguments today on whether the military's mail-only draft is constitutional. We'll look at the arguments for and against that policy coming up. Now, anytime an emerging disease is in the news, a lot of misinformation comes along with it. And the novel coronavirus is no exception. Online sources, both real and robotic, have been spreading false theories and rumors about the origin of the virus. Dr. Jonathan Tempty joins us now to talk about misinformation about the illness and why it's important to get things right. Dr. Tempty is Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He's been active on pandemic influenza and bioterrorism working groups for the state of Wisconsin. His current research interests include viral disease surveillance in primary care, seasonality, and epidemiology of influenza. Dr. Tempty, welcome back to Central Time.
And thank you so much for having me, Rob.
Before we tackle some of the misinformation, let's look at where to get the good stuff. What are our reliable sources if we want to get the real deal?
Well, I think there are two main sources for people who are really interested in this. First, the Centers for Disease Control does a very, very good job of summarizing what we know about this virus. More closer to home, the Wisconsin Division of Public Health at the Department of Health Services has a website that they update every day, I believe, at 2 o'clock, and it provides really good information on what's happening here in Wisconsin.
Now, there's so much out there. NPR did kind of a roundup of some of the bad info they've seen. And let's start with exaggerating the threat and underplaying the threat. Let's start with the exaggerating side. They cited some people making looking at the death numbers, multiplying by 50 or so, and giving these hugely inflated numbers for the death toll of coronavirus. What is the hazard of doing something like that?
Anytime you overemphasize, it makes people panicked. It drives all sorts of unproductive behavior. For example, right now we're seeing news media reports of shops or stores running out of Clorox, of people buying out all the face masks and so on. And so it makes people much more worried about what is going on than we need to be at this time.
And we've also seen at the other end of things, people saying this is basically just comparable to the common cold. Now, it's not apocalyptic, but it's not common cold either, is it?
And the concern there is then people tend to dismiss it when, in fact, we should be taking this very seriously. What we do know is this is a respiratory virus for which humans don't have any existing immunity. is brand new into our bodies, and so we don't have any really good defense. And when that happens, you have a virus that can spread very, very quickly. And if you look, we've gone from the first few cases in China, probably in early December, to a global reach of this virus on almost all continents except Antarctica. So that's really, really fast. But we are still fairly ignorant in terms of what the consequences are going to be.
Let's talk a little more about the consequences. And so this is a fast-spreading virus, we know, and it can be hard to detect, I understand. How about the lethality of the coronavirus as we've seen it so far?
What we're able to go off right now is the number of deaths in people for whom coronavirus was confirmed. Mm-hmm. And then we have the total number of people with confirmed coronavirus. What we don't know is the number of people out there with illness, perhaps fairly mild, that have coronavirus. And when you have limited supplies of testing tools and diagnostic equipment, you're limited in who you choose to test. What that does is it makes the death rate seem higher than it probably is. That being said, this is a virus that a lot of the virological experts out there and people who are involved in public health say this is probably worse than seasonal influenza. It's probably not as bad as the great influenza pandemic 102 years ago. But it's something that we really need to be aware of and treat with respect.
How much of the lethality of a virus like this or the one 100 years ago, the pandemic you were talking about, has to do with the disease, the virus itself? How much of it has to do with our public health system, how we react to it?
Well, I think most of that is due to the lethality of the virus. Respiratory viruses in general are incredibly hard to contain. You know, in 2009, we had this new pandemic of influenza A, H1N1. And despite all the efforts, it circled the globe very, very quickly. I oftentimes will equate trying to stop a respiratory virus with trying to stop water with a sieve. It just really flows through populations very, very quickly. There are things you can do to slow it down, and good public health can do that. For example, maintaining social distances, occasionally closing down schools or limiting large gatherings. Sometimes it means changing the way we travel. And all those were imposed pretty rigidly in China. And my guess, it slowed things down, but did not stop it.
Talking to Dr. Jonathan Temte from the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the novel coronavirus, clearing up some misinformation that's out there. Dr. Temte, whenever we have an emerging disease like this, there's often a conspiracy theory that it was weaponized in a lab somewhere. In this case, people are saying China. The evidence people are offering behind that is, well, natural diseases don't spread this quickly. That is rubbish, I imagine.
Yeah, natural diseases can actually spread this quickly. We don't have to look any further back than 2 or 3 years ago with the Zika virus when it arrived in Brazil and then exploded through the Caribbean. And we went from no cases to very widespread where the conditions were correct in a matter of months. So that is something we see over and over again. And it has much more to do with how contagious the virus is and some of the characteristics of that virus itself. But with this particular one, we don't have that backstop or that slowing down process that's imposed by having some immunity. And these can really take off like wildfire.
Another concern that comes up with this is, can we get a vaccine? Can we have a cure? We've heard even from the president saying we could have a vaccine within months, not a year, year and a half. What do we know about the pace of a vaccine development, if it's even possible to do that?
Well, vaccines are able to be developed fairly quickly these days. And we'll give the Chinese government the credit for very rapidly fully sequencing or basically dissecting out the entire genome of this virus and sharing it across the world. A vaccine can be developed quickly, but the difficult part is then testing it for two important components. One is it safe in people? And number two, is it effective? And without it being both safe and effective, a vaccine doesn't go very far. And so coming up with the constituent parts can be relatively quick, but the rest of it takes a while. And so I would think we're looking more at, again, as the experts in vaccine development are saying, about 18 months.
Now, let's talk about bad information about remedies. I've seen people already selling things that they say are going to cure the disease caused by this coronavirus. People have recommended covering yourself in sesame oil, which I imagine isn't going to be a big help. And even there's been a claim that ingesting a particular dangerous substance can kill the coronavirus. What do you make of this kind of misinformation, these false claims of cures?
Well, again, we don't have any scientific evidence for any of these. There have been some medications used in the class called antivirals previously for SARS. And there are some ongoing trials of these medications right now to see if there is any efficacy and also if it's a safe medication to be using. But as far as other things out there, we don't really have any interventions medically other than good supportive care.
For people listening worried about this, so what kind of personal hygiene, personal care can we do when we're thinking about coronavirus or when we're thinking about a flu season?
Well, this applies to virtually all the respiratory viruses, from influenza to coronavirus to the common cold rhinovirus. These are all spread through respiratory secretion. So coughing or sneezing will project literally millions of viral particles out there. And by sitting close or being close to somebody who's coughing or sneezing puts you within the cloud of these viral particles that you can breathe in, and they can infect you. Coughing or sneezing onto a surface and then touching that surface and wiping your nose or your eye can transmit the virus as well. So the things that we always talk about are really common sense. Number one, maintaining some distance away from people who are coughing and sneezing. Number two, good hand washing repeatedly. And soap and water works just fine for this virus, but you have to do it long enough. About 20 minutes or 20 seconds is what we're recommending, not 20 minutes, but 20 seconds of hand washing, and do that repeatedly throughout the day. Those are things that can help. We don't know if a face mask will protect you, but face masks are very good for people who are actively coughing or sneezing because it catches that movement of air and deflects it to the side and behind, and also catches some of the droplets. So those are the things that we would recommend.
What's the message for people if they think they might have it? We don't want to overwhelm the healthcare system with people who don't have a threatening flu or novel coronavirus. But who should be thinking if they see the signs of it, yeah, I should probably get checked out?
Well, I think at this point in time, what we know is this is a virus that can cause anything from a very mild respiratory infection, like a sore throat, a runny nose, all the way up to severe shortness of breath. And given that we have limited resources, and at this time in Wisconsin, we have had only one case that has been confirmed, one would say that in Wisconsin, we don't have much going on right now. This is where it's important to pay attention to credible sources, and I'm going to pick on the Department of Health Services, Division of Public Health right now, because they're the best source of Wisconsin data. And paying attention there, and if we start seeing more cases here, then there should be advice saying who should come in and who shouldn't. And this is going to probably be very much like influenza. If people are having a mild illness, no shortness of breath, not terribly high fever, they can shelter at home, be isolated from others, and they'll get through. People who have underlying medical conditions are probably at more risk. As we've seen, most of the cases out there, most of the hospitalizations and most of the deaths have been in people over the age of 40 or 50 years old, and almost all of them have some underlying medical condition.
Dr. Tempte, thanks a lot for joining us today.
And thank you very much.
That's Dr. Jonathan Tempte, Dean for Public Health and Community Engagement for the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. We talked to him today about identifying and beating misinformation about the coronavirus disease, COVID-19. Coming up, we'll look at whether it's time to end the military's mail-only draft system. That's up next on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow at 8 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the big stories from Super Tuesday elections around the country and what it could mean for Wisconsin's primary vote. That's tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a panel of federal appeals court judges heard arguments today on whether the military's mail-only draft is constitutional. About a year ago, a federal judge in Texas ruled that it is unconstitutional. The Trump administration appealed, setting the stage for today's activity in the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. The last draft was in 1973, but every male still has to register when they turn 18. Now that women are eligible for combat roles, that Texas judge ruled that having only men be draft eligible is discriminatory. Today's hearing comes 3 weeks before a federal commission releases its recommendations on the mail-only draft and other matters. Patricia Keim is a freelance journalist who covers the military, veterans, and health care for Military Times, The New York Times, Kaiser Health News, and other publications. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, this case was filed some years back. What was the original basis for the case being brought?
Well, so the case was brought by a Texas gentleman who was in the right age group for having to register for the draft. And he managed to get some other plaintiffs on board, including an organization called the National Coalition for Men, arguing that because women, the case was filed in 2013, and at that time, the DOD lifted some restrictions on women being in combat. And he argued that since women were going to be allowed in combat, that the policy to only have men register for the draft was either needed to be abolished or it needed to include women.
And we had a judge agree with that claim previously, but it didn't. That judge didn't force the military to comply. What was the argument from the judge there?
Well, the argument for the judge was that it was unconstitutional to only require men to register because it violates the due process clause of the Fifth Amendment. I'm not exactly a lawyer, but that clause includes an equal protection basically, the courts have ruled that that also includes equal protection, which means that everyone deserves equality of treatment and that the policy that was the law is discriminatory because it did bar women from registering.
But the judge in that case didn't say, okay, military, start registering everybody now, right?
Right. I think one of the reasons the judge chose not to, basically federal attorneys made a pretty strong argument for waiting for the outcome of a commission that is currently studying the future of the Selective Service System. So there is a National Commission on the Military, National, and Public Service, which was established in 2016 to study the future of the draft, as well as public service in general in America, determining whether, there should be some kind of mandatory service or expanding opportunities for young people to serve the federal government or their local governments or volunteer organizations or serve in the military.
Talking to Patricia Keim about draft registration in the United States and a court case challenging the current system, which requires only men to register for the draft. Patricia, let's bring things up to today now. We have this Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals hearing. What are the arguments on both sides here?
So obviously, the federal government has asked that the judges wait until the outcome of the Blue Ribbon Panel's study, which is expected actually at the end of March. And they also say that it would be disruptive and burdensome to add, thousands, millions of women to the roles of the draft of the Selective Service System. On the original plaintiff's side, they believe that it needs to be changed because it is a policy that sort of conveys that men are disposable, and they believe that now that women are in, you know, allowed in combat and all combat roles are open to women, that everyone should be required to sign up for the draft, or we should just take a hard look at it and get rid of the selective service system altogether.
So we've got two shoes waiting to drop here, what this appeals court ends up doing and this commission. Let's talk a little more about the commission. Are they looking at wider issues than just, men or men and women in draft registration?
Very much so. I mean, they're looking at, the budget of the $23 million that the Selective Service System, costs every year. We haven't had a draft, as you said earlier, since, 1973. The draft was abolished, yet we've maintained the Selective Service System. They're exploring whether it's a needed thing now with an all-volunteer army military. And they're also looking at other opportunities that young people can serve. I know that they were taking a really hard look at basically civics and involvement with young people in their own government and trying to figure out how to get people more involved in the process.
Is this federal commission ultimately the decider, or if they recommend drastically overhauling our draft registration system, does Congress, the president, are they going to weigh in next?
Yes, that's what would happen. So basically, the commission was organized by Congress. It has a number of representatives on the panel that represent, all walks of life. But this report goes to Congress, which will consider it and decide whether perhaps legislation needs to be created based on their findings. And then ultimately, the White House would have the final say.
Now, jumping back to the appeals court now in New Orleans, I know it's tough to predict what a court is going to do, but did the judges on this Court of Appeals have an interest or express any particular interest in aspects of the arguments that both sides were raising?
Well, so it's interesting. I talked with the attorney for the original plaintiffs today, and he said that it seemed to go well. The judges were very interested in both sides of the argument. He said that one judge in particular was very interested in what is really the legal process as to whether the original judge in Texas had the really legal right to overturn what was a Supreme Court ruling affirming the male-only draft. That decision was in 1981, and there was some legal discussion as to whether that's an appropriate ruling. So whether the actual outcome ends up hinging on a legal argument and not on the actual merits of the case will be very interesting.
We'll be watching for the results in that court and from this commission later this month. Patricia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Have a good day.
You too. That's Patricia Keim, freelance journalist. She covers the military, veterans, and healthcare for the Military Times, New York Times, and other publications. We talked to her about a court case over whether the military's male-only draft is constitutional. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll check out the results of Super Tuesday voting around the country and what it means for the Democratic presidential race. A lot of big websites have changed to keep up with the times. Others fallen by the wayside because they didn't keep up. Then there's Craigslist. We'll check out the story of the site that changed the way we buy stuff from random strangers and what its future could look like. Plus, scary stories are scary, so why do we like them? We'll talk to a psychologist about the benefits of spooky stuff for our brains. That and more, it's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, parenting can feel like an overwhelming job, but Kate's guest says we can make a big difference just by being present for our kids. Meet the co-author of the new book, The Power of Showing Up, How Parental Presence Shapes Who Our Kids Become and How Their Brains Get Wired. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then, what do some of your favorite science fiction shows, TV shows, books, movies tell us about society? Maybe more than you think. We'll talk to a sociology professor about things like Black Mirror, Get Out, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.